Welcome, William. How are you this afternoon?
Very good.
Well, as founder director of Gurdjieff Studies Programs, what personally drew you to the teachings of Gurdjieff?
Deeply, though I couldn't formulate it then, a desire for knowledge, why we were here, what we were doing here, what was of value, what was of meaning. I remembered kissing my grandmother's forehead after she died, and it was cold like stone. And it just went right into me, those questions. But I was so young, but it created a question that then I could later formulate, is what I just told you.
For those who aren't familiar with Gurdjieff, can you give us a little background into how he became such an influential spiritual teacher?
Well, he was the, in my view, the seminal spiritual teacher of the last century, and probably the century to come. He was born in 1872. He died in 1949. And in that time, he came to the whole sensation of himself. Usually we're just in a part of our sensation, but it was the whole sensation of himself really vibrating. He looked around and he saw so much misery, confusion, and what have you, that he came to the question, what was the purpose of life on earth and human life in particular? And with that, he set out with some like-minded friends. They called themselves the Seekers of Truth. They felt that the remote societies of the world contained perhaps the answers to these questions. And this eventually led him to Egypt. And he was initiated 4 times into the Egyptian mysteries and began to recognize that the science of being, the teaching that predates all teaching, was founded in Egypt. And then over time it was dispersed northward. So he had the blueprint of the teaching itself. And then he took a second journey into the Hindu Kush, Tibet, India, Middle East, what have you, collecting the various pieces of the teaching. And then he reformulated for our time and he brought it to the West. He came to the West in 1924 because he said, unless the energy of the West and the science of the East is harnessed and used harmoniously, the world will destroy itself. So he felt he needed to bring an esoteric teaching into the public domain, a teaching of self-development, of coming to genuine consciousness.
And this is what he called the fourth way, correct?
That's right. There are three classical ways. There's the way of the body, the fakir, the way of the heart, the monk, and the way of the mind, which is the jnana yogi. The fourth way combines all three. We work on the body, the emotions, and the head simultaneously.
Now, he also taught that humans are not born with the soul and they're not really conscious, but only believe they're conscious because of the socialization process. And so a person must create or develop a soul through the course of his life. Can you talk about this?
That's right. We've all been led to believe we have a soul, though the definition of a soul and the experience of a soul seems rather non-scientific. His view was that we did not have a soul. And if we didn't create a soul in this lifetime, then when we died, we would just become fertilizer.
So, do we wake up through the creation process of making our own soul? Because you talked about how everyone's in a state of a hypnotic waking sleep. Man lives life in his sleep and then he dies and sleeps.
That's right. You can't wake yourself up because you're not an indivisible I. You're many eyes. As it says in the Bible, man's name is Legion. So we're many eyes, we're just not one. We have to become an individual I. And in doing that, we create not a soul to begin with, but what he calls a Kejdan body, then an emotional body, then a mental body, and finally the soul. The good news is, if you just create a Kejdan body, then it's likely you can return. Otherwise, there's nothing there when we die.
So, thinking of the many eyes, does man have any unity within himself? It seems kind of schizophrenic then, doesn't it?
Well, we live in complete unity all the time because the body-mind is basically adjust immediately to whatever thought, emotion, impulse we're having. So we live in a unison, but it's not an aware unison.
So how would he view the collective? A lot of New Agers talk about how we're all one. What would he say to that?
Imagination.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of his sayings was, life is real only when I am. I am, you are, we all are, that, and that is, correct?
Life is real only then when I am. Right? It should be basically, I think, life is real only then when I am, capital A, right, capital I. And life is always real. The problem is I'm not real. So I wake up to higher and higher degrees of consciousness of sleep.
Wow. So people in their typical state function as unconscious automatons, as he said, but one can wake up and become a different sort of human being altogether. So what kind of human being is that?
Well, we can cease to become a machine. So in doing that, we become, as he says, an image of God. The only true thing, idea that has reached us is that we are images of God, but we're undeveloped images of God. So we have to, like the old camera film, we have to pass through a solution and be hung out to dry. And then what is positive simply comes into view. We're developed.
Mm-hmm. Gurdjieff focused on two main cosmic laws, the law of three and the law of seven. Can you talk about this?
Well, the law of three, Triumvasi Kamno, is the active, the passive, and the neutralizing. We see this in Indian psychology with the gunas, but they're static. Here, the three forces, the active, the passive, the neutral, are all vibrating and changing places all the time within us and, of course, in the outer world. And then there is the law of seven, which is an octave, that everything to complete itself has seven movements, beginning with, for example, the musical scale, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, da. The problem is that most people, in beginning something, they begin at a do, I want to do this, and then their will runs out or they get interested in other things, so it's do, re, mi, an abortive octave. So we start so many things and we never finish them because we don't have the will and the awareness and the desire to do that. So it's managing the law of three within the law of seven consciously that allows us to complete projects consciously.
Interesting. Yeah, the fourth way also focuses on the ability to constantly perform what he called conscious labors and intentional suffering. So what is intentional suffering?
Well, it's an intentional suffering when I withdraw myself from the hypnotism of life and the self-image that I'm living. That can be a moral suffering when I see that I'm all self-image. It's not the suffering that happens when you break your finger or you lose your boyfriend or something like that. This is a moral suffering that I've been living. What's been living me is the life of an imposter, the false personality. And I begin to see, as he says, that I have to learn to be sincere. Learn to be sincere. We all think we're sincere. But to be really sincere is to move into the world of these different eyes and to see how the contradictions arise and what have you.
Yeah. And what is conscious labor?
Conscious labor is when you do something intentionally from a point of view of awareness, and that means you become embodied. Most people are not embodied. We look like we're here. We feel like we're here when we're angry or in some extreme situation, but basically, where are we generally? We're in our head. We're commenting, talking about what? About me, 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 me. So it's to come into the body, to redirect the attention. For example, right now, we might perform a little experiment if you're ready.
Okay.
Okay. Where is your right foot right now?
It's crossed over my left leg.
Did you know that before?
No.
No.
I think I did in the back of my head, but now it's in the forefront of my head. Oh, yes, my legs are crossed.
You see, what happened when you recognized your legs were crossed? Either you looked visually or you transferred your attention into your leg and recognized that's where it was. We're so mental, we live out of the head. But if you now put your right foot on the floor and breathe into it, come to the sensation of the right leg. Fill the right leg with your attention and your breath and try to maintain that. And we can go on talking.
Yeah. I felt relaxed as soon as I did that.
Exactly.
So does this have to do with the centers that Gurdjieff talked about?
Well, this has to do primarily with the redirection of the attention into the body, out of the head brain, out of the hypnotism of life, into physical reality. Your body and my body is here, but am I aware of it? Is there a conscious sensation of this? Usually not. I am lost in thought, in imagination, fears, the future, historicizing, what have you. So we live in a very mental world, and very few people are actually here in the body. Once you're in the body, then we can talk about centers. Up to that point, it's just a word.
So what about people that spend a lot of time meditating and they're actually out of their body? Is this not a good thing?
To go out of your body is to be in your body. And to have the body expand, that you come to what is called the blank state in meditation, where there's just subject-object. I might say before I say this, we think in perception that we're all living in subject-object perception. But if I really examine myself seriously, I'll see my attention is either out of myself or in myself. I'm either attracted to something outside or something has happened internally that has taken my attention. So I'm really not in subject-object attention. So through doing the meditation that we prescribe, you come into the body, you experience a subject-object perception, recognition, and eventually, you come down through the various material you're carrying, the memories, the things you have not digested, to what's called a blank state, where there's just a subject, your consciousness, and the object that you are sitting. If you can maintain this long enough, at a certain point, you'll have a double absence. There will be no subject, there will be no object, and you'll be in total consciousness.
Hmm. Yeah, well, this is interesting because if we are, like you've said, bioplasmic machines, we're already programmed a certain way. Is part of what you're explaining basically a deprogramming process to override the machine?
Absolutely. It's to debrief the head brain and the emotional center of everything they're carrying. And the same with the body itself, right? Readjusting, re-educating the nervous system, the mind, what have you. And I might say, you can't do this alone. We live in a time when everybody wants to be their own teacher. We're afraid of other teachers. We've read all these stories and what have you. If we are, in fact, all these different eyes, then what eye is going to teach me? It's just an eye. I need a teacher. But a lot of people, what they do is they read books and maybe listen to programs like this, and they put together their own idea of what is being said, and they just lock themselves into what I would call the esoteric eye.
So then how does one begin this self-observation process?
That's a very good question. First of all, If I am totally hypnotized, an automaton, an ongoing reality, where can I begin? I can't begin there, can I?
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So what is there? What is there is what I have, which is my attention, my energy, and my time. I have to learn to withdraw that from the ongoing hypnotic reality to myself. And then when I'm ensconced within myself, I've come to physical reality, then I observe what is happening with me mentally, emotionally, instinctually, sexually. And I will see that I am, in fact, not an individual, but a assemblage of various eyes according to what is going on internally and externally. That has to be verified by everybody, because naturally everybody thinks they're an individual and awake and all of these ideas and have a soul. It's a good crowd control.
What do you mean?
Well, by telling people that they are awake, that they have a soul, that they need to be societally adjusted and perform good works and so forth and so on, it makes for a society that's stable.
Hmm. So how does the new era of science play into this then? Are we just going deeper into the slumber?
In one way we are. Science is basically, it started, I believe, back in the caveman days when someone observed lightning hitting a tree and a fire starting. And so they made an intuitive jump that if they could take two pieces of wood and rub them together, they might get fire, which they did. There had to be some experience like that that woke up the mind. And from that point of view till now, it's been a constant waking of the mind to where we are now in the world of technology. And it has marvelous powers. It can do many things for us, take us many places and what have you. But technology is not neutral. It is reforming the way we think, the way we live, the way we use our energy, the way we relate to people, and so forth and so on. So we've created in a way, just as we're the son of God, we've created the son of man, the robo-sapien. They even talk about the robo-sapien having self-awareness now. Now, it can't have the self-awareness I'm talking about, but it can demonstrate that to a degree that people might believe that. So it's really facing us with the age-old question, who am I? Why am I here? What's all this about? And I've got to work with science as well as myself in terms of creating a Kejtan body, at least a soul, hopefully, so that I come to a deeper and deeper consciousness of which technology plays its part, but it's not overriding me.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I will lose my spiritual potential and simply become a machine, a bioplasmic machine. And that's the great danger we all live in.
It's already happened. If I look around, I already see that.
That's right. It's already happening. And it's taking away one's identity. The identity most people have is with the job that they do. When you take away a person's job, what's their identity? They're open to anything. So we seem to keep taking jobs away and people unemployed and so forth and so on. There's going to be a reaction at some point. And I wouldn't be surprised if we would see a coup here, but who knows? What I wouldn't want to get involved with that. What I would want to do is learn to work with technology by being present to myself. So I use technology, and I'm not used by it.
And then we have the transhumanists and the Apple crowd, which is it's basically developing a new religion. Don't you see that?
Oh, yes, exactly. I've talked about that. That's right. But what is the transhuman crowd? I haven't heard of that.
Ah, yeah, exactly. It's basically the idea of man morphing with machines.
Oh, yes. Oh,
Yeah.
okay. Yes. Oh, yes.
Trying to extend their life and upload their consciousness. I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but they're trying.
The fact that they would even try seems to me to be a devaluation of the human being and his or her potential as an image of God. I think a lot of people who we affectionately call nerds tend to be so in their heads and so quick and look down on other people and just believe there will be no more crime or war if people could become robo sapiens or transhuman beings. That's not going to happen.
Do you feel, and how did Gercha feel about this, that we actually need to have some kind of conflict in order to evolve?
Oh, definitely. An angel can't evolve. It has no struggle with itself. It's pure goodness.
So a lot of these people that claim that Earth should be a utopia or we should be a socialist kind of society, what would Gercha say about that?
He said Marxism is satanic.
That's great. I feel that way too. Can you explain more about that?
Well, that's a long conversation, but Marxism is central control by government of human beings and their dealings. Who is a government that's controlling and why? It's going to control for power, its own power. We see that in the Soviet Union right now.
Yeah, I know Gurdjieff, he wasn't in favor of anything that claimed change by the masses because it had to be an individual effort. So each individual eventually will make up the masses, right?
Exactly. Exactly. His belief was that by really learning to be sincere, having a desire for knowledge, practicing the teaching he brought, which is a seminal sacred esoteric teaching that hails from ancient Egypt, not the Egypt we know, but the Egypt we don't know, when we practice that, we begin to receive energies and transmit energies on a very high level that affect the world around us and the people in it. And in that way, we can have an effect. And with myself in writing these books and videos and holding seminars and leading groups, I'm hoping to bring the people who are with me to their own individuality so that they can go out and do the same for others. Look at all the teachings that have come to us, beginning with the Hindu. The slayer and the slain are one. That's a very, very high teaching, all right? But how to get there, right? Then we have Ten Commandments, right? Judaism. Then we have Jesus, love thy neighbor, resplendent love. And then we have Muhammad, Allah is all, right? Now Gurdjieff comes and says, you have no soul. No matter how intelligent you are or what you do or don't do, when you die, there will be really nothing crystallized, nothing there, and you will become fertilizer. If you work on yourself, if you come to yourself, if you reclaim yourself as an image of God, then you will be working at a much higher level here on Earth, and when you die, the crystallization will pass into the solar system and eventually become immortal within the solar system. And you will do a great deal of good for yourself and for other people. Your life will always have meaning because you have meaning.
Now, let's get into Gurdjieff's moon theory, because that's very interesting. Do you know much about that?
The moon theory. You mean the
Yeah.
world 96. He's talking about the ray of creation, and it all begins in the Holy Sun Absolute. And out of that come the three forces that we talked about earlier. And they come into the world. In the world, in the universe, is a substance, primal substance called Okedanguk. And these forces meet the Okedanguk, and they create a physical reality on their terms. And of course, the first physical reality is barely physical at all, but there is something there. And then you come down through the ray of creation down to our solar system with the sun and the planets and then the earth, and beyond the earth is the moon. The moon is the world 96. The earth is world 48. The astral worlds are 24, 12, and 6. Most of us are living in world 96, the moon world.
Mm-hmm.
And the moon world is highly dualistic. And because it's highly dualistic, then there's going to be a lot of misery, suffering, war, and everything we see in the media. Has to be that way. Because we have not come to ourselves. We're living out of our ideas. And the ideas are always partial and discriminatory. And there is a me and a you. And out of that comes jealousy and so forth and so on.
And what happened with Ouspensky?
Ouspensky was an old, old soul. He had come here many, many times. He had recognized that we live in eternal recurrence, that our lives happen over and over and over again. And he apparently had tried many different ways. And this time he said he was seeking a new or forgotten road, right? In other words, he was aware of the three classical ways, the way of the body, the way of the monk, the way of the mind. Apparently, I would think that he had tried them. And while they gave results, they didn't give total results. So he was looking for a new or forgotten road, and he went to India twice. He came back. He said, finally, he wanted a teaching of a more rational kind where you didn't have to give up everything at once. In these classical teachings, as practiced in India, you have to go away to an ashram. You have to change your name here in the various monasteries and so forth and so on. In the work, we accept everybody just as they are. The life they're living is perfect for them, given their understanding of themselves and others. What we want to do is take that life and let's look at it. Let's see why I'm doing this or not doing that, and so forth and so on. And so use my very life to awaken to what's real in me.
And part of that focusing your attention is also minimizing daydreaming, correct?
Absolutely. And imagination of all types, other than creative imagination. Now, Mr. Ouspensky, he was Gurdjieff's main pupil in his Russian days, so we think, but I'm now thinking that there are several others that are even higher than he was. But he had a lot of problems with Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff made demands on him to do otherwise, and he felt they were unfair and became very confused, left the teaching. Then he left the teaching, I think, in 1918, 1919. Then he came back in Constantinople with Gurdjieff again. And then he went to England, and he was part of the Priory for a time, and then he left once more. He went out of his own. He broke the teaching, the octave. Been so much more powerful had he not done that. And he was a very sincere and decent man and a great seeker, but he could not, well, as he said, he suffered from, you'll like this, extreme individuality. And he could not break through that, unfortunately. So I suppose if he's right, he's coming back again. According to him, eternal recurrence, you're going to be born on the same day, the same minute that you were born before, and you'll go through it again until you begin to wake up to it, and then you can pass on.
Interesting. So the many eyes, the individual, the collective, help me clarify this. When you say that we're not an individual, help me to understand that. How am I not an individual?
Well, you're an individual in your belief, but as a actuality, no, because you're not in the body. How could you be an individual when you're not even in physical reality? You're in the mind in an image, supported by everyone else who thinks they're individuals. And it's all sleep.
So we're having a shared dream where we're all kind of mind controlling each other?
Yes, of course.
So where are we then? Where do we exist?
Well, you exist as an organic being, unconsciously receiving and transmitting the energies that come to Earth and procreating. We're here to procreate, right? Those people who don't procreate are, from nature's point of view, blanks.
I have not procreated.
Well, there's one out for you. Mr. Gurdjieff says, if you're not in the work of procreation, then you have to create yourself through an authentic teaching. That is the fourth way.
So how can we look at life in terms of energy if we want to shift our thinking?
Well, when you have sex, don't you experience energy?
Sure.
Okay. Now, that's just physical sex, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're really interested in someone, or they're interested in you, for one reason or another, you're experiencing their vibration, aren't you?
Yep.
And those vibrations are mixing. They're being exchanged. We live in a sexual world. We're all sexual, right?
And some maybe more so. So they're stuck in that center as opposed to integrating the other centers, right?
Well, we psychologize it. Sex doesn't need to be psychologized, right? Sex is sex, is beautiful and wonderful, and as Mr. Gurdjieff says, it's a divine sacrament, because when two conscious beings enter into an exchange of substances, they will pass out of gender. You'll no longer be a man or a woman. You'll pass out of gender and experiencing divine sex, where you're not one or the other.
So gender neutral.
Bypassing gender.
So what were his views on psychology?
He did not have a very good view of psychology, because it was only working with memory, socially adjusting people to the ordinary. The people who are psychologists aren't there. They're there as Jungians, Freudians, Adler, what have you, or whatever they put together, but they're not in the body. And they are listening to people who are not in the body. So it's all entertainment.
Yeah, it's a whole lot of drama, usually.
Right. You go to the psychologist or a therapist, the shrink, and you offload what is bothering you. He or she listens, maybe gives you some pointers. You leave and you feel better because you've offloaded all this energy, but it comes back and there you are again, right?
Mm-hmm.
As you begin to inhabit the body, mind, consciously, you open up to what you're carrying in the subconscious, and that comes up in your consciousness and you eat it. And as you eat it, you weaken it. And a lot of what we carry will just be destroyed forever. Some things are strong enough to remain, but when they come up, then we use that as a reminder to remember ourselves. So we clean out the closet, you might say.
I see. Interesting. So I also hear a lot of people talking about, specifically in the alternative fields and media, that they're pushing for this global shift in consciousness. Is this even possible? Is this part of our imagination or a delusion if we're not even in the body completely and some of us maybe are even soulless?
That's true. No matter what would happen, if I'm not here in physical reality, I can't take advantage of it, and I will certainly egoify it, right? I'll make it dualistic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So whatever I'm given, I am going to pollute. As long as I'm not here and taking conscious responsibility for myself. You see, you don't have any responsibility until you're awake, because there's no choice. Only when there's a choice and I have the will to do right or wrong, or go left or go high or whatever, am I responsible? So one of the reasons I believe people keep themselves asleep is they don't want the responsibility. Because if you're not here, whatever you do, what happens to who's not here? You die and you become marred, fertilizer.
So that's it for you? Game over? You don't get to come back?
No, and why would you?
Yeah, well, that's how I feel. If you're here, you have to honestly live. Some people come here and they just don't even live. They don't even try to live their life.
They don't even know about it, right?
Yeah.
But if you look at the different teachings that were brought, you know, we started with the Hindus, slayer and the slain is one, right? Oneness. Mm-hmm. And you go down through the Ten Commandments and love and Allah is one. Look at all of those teachings. They're all very good. But here Mr. Gurdjieff comes and pulls the rug out from under them all. You have no soul. You're not awake. And you'll become nothing unless you work on yourself. Here are the laws. Here's the way crystallization happens. Here's the practices. Go for it. That's never been given before.
Yeah.
It's esoteric knowledge.
But yet also wasn't some of this knowledge, I think you said one of your videos, basically esoteric Christianity, a version of Christianity before the Jesus Christ?
Exactly. He was contemptuous of contemporary Christianity, but esoteric Christianity is the foundation of the fourth way. And it comes from ancient Egypt, only not the Egypt we know. So there was a Christianity before the birth of Christ. The Trinity was known before the birth of Christ, and love, and so forth and so on. And then over time, things weaken or pass down, change forms, and so forth. So we're going back to the beginning with the fourth way, as amazing as that sounds. But if we try it, we don't have to certainly believe that or anything I've said today. The point is to verify it. That's the foundation of the work. So the foundation of the work is verification, which is scientific, which I believe then makes us the teaching for this time.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere, I don't know if this is right information, but about the moon collecting the souls of underdeveloped humans basically as food for the moon. Is this correct?
Yes, yes. We will be food for the moon. You have to go someplace, you know.
Yeah, because there's a lot of theories, too, that the moon was actually dragged and put into its place. It wasn't originally there.
Well, Mr. Gurdjieff believed that a comet hit the Earth and separated from the Earth two moons. One he called the moon or Anulios, and another, which the science have just found out about, called Torah. It's a very small moon, and it comes around not too often. But there are two moons, not one. And it's because of a comet hitting the Earth, which I believe some people at Harvard, astronomers, what have you, are beginning to recognize.
Does the fourth way mention anything about humanity's ancient past, as the different forms of humanity that have been on the planet?
Yes, it does. Mr. Gurdjieff talks about he's talking about what we would know. I think maybe you're using the word forms in a different way, which he does not. He talks about past civilizations. But he doesn't talk about people being here with two heads or three arms.
Well, in these past civilizations, were they more evolved? Have we de-evolved?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
So what was it like before? Was there a golden age?
Well, these are all ideas, aren't they?
Yeah.
How can I verify them? See, I'm only interested in what I can verify. Now, if we want to have a beer together and have some good talk, we could talk about that. But you wouldn't know any more than I would. It'd just be what our predilection would be.
So it's about verifying what life is about as opposed to how you should live your life.
Right. Okay. How you should live your life is up to you, but it should come out of consciousness and not some control mechanism of your parents or your society.
Same with morality. All these thoughts are foisted upon us, right?
That's right, exactly.
Morality, rights, what's freedom?
Everyone's a little neurotic about sex, but as I say, we live in a sexual world. We are sexual beings. There should be no surprise about that. And it's a wonderful experience. And it's going on all the time, not only physically. With people you know that you like very much, there's an exchange of substances.
Sure. It's an energy exchange. Well, right. I find it interesting that most religions condone sex. Christianity is very strict about that. All of the Islam, Judaism, somewhere along the line, that was altered.
That's right.
And it's made people more weird, a little crazy, you know?
And I think to a great degree, it was that we really hadn't, as a society, very few societies, worked out their relationship of man to woman. So you see in the Middle East, women wear burkas. Here in the West, they wear, bikinis and less, right? These are two extremes, right? And we try to relate in that way, but we can't. We have to relate consciously and see what that is, because every man is a woman and every woman is a man. And what is that when you come together and you're conscious, right? You have to explore that.
So as we begin to wrap up, what are some other important things that you want us to know about Gurdjieff?
Well, you've been asking some very good questions. What haven't I answered that you'd like to know about?
Maybe you could give us a couple tips on his methods to minimize some absent-mindedness.
Well, one of the things that he worked with was adulation. You know, he was a man of great being and great knowledge. And so students would very often fall into idolizing him. And when they did, he would act otherwise. Because what they were doing was they were passing off their responsibility onto him for waking up. Mm-hmm. You should idolize yourself, right, in a real way, and not other people.
So does that mean we should just go with the flow of life, whatever happens, even if it's bad events or bad things that happen to us?
Well, no, of course not. We should become involved in creating a soul. And then everything takes care of itself. Then you need a practice. Then you need a teaching. And this is the teaching for our time. I believe that sincerely. I've practiced it now for over 40 years. Now, you may have a genetic functioning or organic problems, what have you. That's not going to cure that. But every time you come to yourself and observe yourself, conscious labor and intentional suffering, you step into physical reality, into a new time, right? The time we're living in is a psychological time. It's not real time at all. So you are rest aging. Want to grow younger?
Yeah, of course. I'd like to stay 34 for a while. I'm liking it.
Well, we have a Gurdjieff Studies program.
One last question for you before we get into your websites and everything. So how do you view this world that we currently live in? It's pretty toxic. The planet's being poisoned. Our government's becoming very fascist. How do you personally relate to that using these teachings?
Well, sometimes I do get upset. My wife reminds me of that. But I recognize that it's all historical. It can't be otherwise because of the choices we have made and not made down through time that largely have been unconscious. So however those unconscious forces, actions play out is on a historical level. To a great degree, it has nothing to do with me. I know what foods to eat, where to live, how to breathe, and so forth and so on. But of course, I'm in that matrix. You are affected to one degree or another, but you work with that. Same. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking to be living in paradise.
Some people are. It's amazing.
But why?
Yeah, exactly. They want to avoid confrontation. They want to avoid dealing with themselves. They want to stay the slave, I guess. That's all I can think of.
And well, then the world of technology is just right for them because it's going to take everything away. Mm. Right? Everything. It's amazing.
And then it always goes bad. Even the sci-fi movies show that if you're having soulless people programming technology, it's going to go bad.
Mm-hmm, of course. Has to. The great egotism that comes with having a fine mind without really being embodied and coming to conscience, particular to Mr. Gurdjieff's way, is conscience. coming to conscience. He says the ways of faith, love, etc. have been polluted, that only conscience exists as a way forward, and conscience is in the subconscious, and we reach that by becoming conscious.
It's good advice.
So when we come to conscience, you can't hurt another person without hurting yourself. You'll feel it. Because you are one. Because the people who said that at the beginning of the program, they're right, but they haven't experienced it yet. They haven't worked for it.
Yeah, well, because quite honestly, to be one with some of these soulless people right now would be hell. You know, I don't want to exchange energy with that.
Well, then you're putting yourself on a platform, aren't you? How do you know?
My husband doesn't feel that way.
Of course he wouldn't. He's completely snowed by you, I'm sure.
Okay, William, how about you give us your websites and let us know about any seminars or events you have going on?
Okay, it's GurdjieffLegacy.org. GurdjieffLegacy.org. And there you'll find information about the teaching, about books and other products we carry, information about me, and information about coming events. I'm giving a seminar in Casa de Maria in Santa Barbara at a retreat center the first weekend in December. And the theme of the seminar, you'll like this, conscious relationship.
Great. Well, thank you, William, so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.